Second, you should imagine energy in the form of particles' masses and their motion endlessly shifting back and forth from one quantum field to another as they continually vibrate through space and time. Quantum electrodynamics is arguably the most precise theory of natural phenomena ever advanced. An illustration of its precision can be found in the work of Toichiro Kinoshita, a particle physicist from Cornell University, who has, over the last 30 years, painstakingly used quantum electrodynamics to calculate certain detailed properties of electrons. Kinoshita's calculations fill thousands of pages and have ultimately required the most powerful computers in the world to complete. But the effort has been well worth it. The calculations yield predictions about electrons that have been experimentally verified to an accuracy of better than one part in a billion. This is an absolutely astonishing agreement between abstract theoretical calculation and the real world. Through quantum electrodynamics, physicists have been able to solidify the role of photons as the smallest possible bundles of light, and to reveal their interactions with electrically charged particles such as electrons in a mathematically complete, predictive, and convincing framework. The success of quantum electrodynamics inspired other physicists in the 1960s and 1970s to try an analogous approach for developing a quantum mechanical understanding of the weak, the strong, and the gravitational forces. For the weak and the strong forces, this proved to be an immensely fruitful line of attack. In analogy with quantum electrodynamics, physicists were able to construct quantum field theories for the strong and the weak forces, called quantum chromodynamics and quantum electroweak theory. Quantum chromodynamics is a more colorful name than the more logical quantum strong dynamics, but it is just a name without any deeper meaning. On the other hand, the name electroweak does summarize an important milestone in our understanding of the forces of nature. Through their Nobel Prize-winning work, Sheldon Glashow, Abdus Salam, and Steven Weinberg showed that the weak and electromagnetic forces are naturally united by their quantum field theoretical description, even though their manifestations seem to be utterly distinct in the world around us. After all, weak force fields diminish to almost vanishing strength on all but subatomic distance scales, whereas electromagnetic fields, visible light, radio and TV signals, X-rays, have an indisputable macroscopic presence. Nevertheless, Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg showed, in essence, that at high enough energy and temperature, such as occurred a mere fraction of a second after the Big Bang, electromagnetic and weak force fields dissolve into one another, take on indistinguishable characteristics, and are more accurately called electroweak fields. When the temperature drops, as it has done steadily since the Big Bang, the electromagnetic and weak forces crystallize out in a different manner from their common high-temperature form, through a process known as symmetry breaking that we will describe later, and therefore appear to be distinct in the cold universe we currently inhabit. And so, if you are keeping score, by the 1970s, physicists had developed a sensible and successful quantum mechanical description of three of the four forces, strong, weak, electromagnetic, and had shown that two of the three, weak and electromagnetic, actually share a common origin, the electroweak force. During the past two decades, physicists have subjected this quantum mechanical treatment of the three non-gravitational forces, as they act among themselves and the matter particles introduced in Chapter 1, to an enormous amount of experimental scrutiny. The theory has met all such challenges with aplomb. Once experimentalists measure some 19 parameters, the masses of the fundamental particles, their force charges, the strengths of the three non-gravitational forces, as well as a few other numbers we need not discuss, and theorists put these numbers into the quantum field theories of the matter particles and the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces, the subsequent predictions of the theory regarding the microcosmos agree spectacularly with experimental results. This is true up to the energies capable of pulverizing matter into bits as small as a billionth of a billionth of a meter, the current technological limit. For this reason, Physicists call the theory of the three non-gravitational forces and the three families of matter particles the standard theory, or, more often, the standard model of particle physics. Messenger particles. According to the standard model, just as the photon is the smallest constituent of an electromagnetic field, the strong and the weak force fields have smallest constituents as well. As we discussed briefly in Chapter 1, the smallest bundles of the strong force are known as gluons, and those of the weak force are known as weak gauge bosons, or more precisely, the W and Z bosons. The standard model instructs us to think of these force particles as having no internal structure. In this framework, they are every bit as elementary as the particles in the three families of matter. The photons, gluons, and weak gauge bosons provide the microscopic mechanism for transmitting the forces they constitute. For example, when one electrically charged particle repels another of like electric charge, you can think of it roughly in terms of each particle being surrounded by an electric field, a cloud or mist of electric essence, and the force each particle feels arises from the repulsion between their respective force fields. The more precise microscopic description of how they repel each other, though, is somewhat different. An electromagnetic field is composed of a swarm of photons. The interaction between two charged particles actually arises from their shooting photons back and forth between themselves. In rough analogy to the way in which you can affect a fellow ice skater's motion and your own by hurling a barrage of bowling balls at him or her, two electrically charged particles influence each other by exchanging these smallest bundles of light. An important failing of the ice skater analogy is that the exchange of bowling balls is always repulsive. It always drives the skaters apart. On the contrary, two oppositely charged particles also interact through the exchange of photons, although the resulting electromagnetic force is attractive. It's as if the photon is not so much the transmitter of the force per se, but rather the transmitter of a message of how the recipient must respond to the force in question. For like charged particles, the photon carries the message "move apart," while for oppositely charged particles, it carries the message "come together." For this reason, the photon is sometimes referred to as the messenger particle for the electromagnetic force. Similarly, the gluons and weak gauge bosons are the messenger particles for the strong and weak nuclear forces. The strong force, which keeps quarks locked up inside of protons and neutrons, arises from individual quarks exchanging gluons. The gluons, so to speak, provide the glue that keeps these subatomic particles stuck together. The weak force, which is responsible for certain kinds of particle transmutations involved in radioactive decay, is mediated by the weak gauge bosons. Gauge symmetry. You may have realized that the odd man out in our discussion of the quantum theory of the forces of nature is gravity. Given the successful approach physicists have used with the other three forces, you might suggest that physicists seek a quantum field theory of the gravitational force, a theory in which the smallest bundle of a gravitational force field, the graviton, would be its messenger particle. At first sight, as we now note, this suggestion would appear to be particularly apt because the quantum field theory of the three non-gravitational forces reveals that there is a tantalizing similarity between them and an aspect of the gravitational force we encountered in Chapter 3. Recall that the gravitational force allows us to declare that all observers, regardless of their state of motion, are on absolutely equal footing. Even those whom we would normally think of as accelerating may claim to be at rest, since they can attribute the force they feel to their being immersed in a gravitational field. In this sense, gravity enforces the symmetry. It ensures the equal validity of all possible observational points of view, all possible frames of reference. The similarity with the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces is that they too are all connected with enforcing symmetries, albeit ones that are significantly more abstract than the one associated with gravity. To get a rough feel for these rather subtle symmetry principles, let's consider one important example. Each quark comes in three colors, fancifully called red, green, and blue, although these are merely labels and have no relation to color in the usual visual sense, which determine how it responds to the strong force in much the same way that its electric charge determines how it responds to the electromagnetic force. All the data that have been collected establish that there is a symmetry among the quarks in the sense that the interactions between any two like-colored quarks, red with red, green with green, or blue with blue, are all identical. And similarly, the interactions between any two unlike-colored quarks, red with green, green with blue, or blue with red, are also identical. In fact, the data supports something even more striking. If the three colors, the three different strong charges, that a quark can carry were all shifted in a particular manner, roughly speaking, in our fanciful chromatic language, if red, green, and blue were shifted, for instance, to yellow, indigo, and violet, and even if the details of this shift were to change from moment to moment or from place to place, the interactions between the quarks would be, again, completely unchanged. For this reason, just as we say that a sphere exemplifies rotational symmetry because it looks the same regardless of how we rotate it around in our hands or how we shift the angle from which we view it, we say that the universe exemplifies strong force symmetry. Physics is unchanged by, it is completely insensitive to, these force charge shifts. For historical reasons, physicists also say that the strong force symmetry is an example of gauge symmetry. Here is the essential point. Just as the symmetry between all possible observational vantage points in general relativity requires the existence of the gravitational force, developments relying on work of Hermann Weyl in the 1920s and Chen-Ning Yang and Robert Mills in the 1950s showed that gauge symmetries require the existence of yet other forces. Much like a sensitive environmental control system that keeps temperature, air pressure, and humidity in an area completely constant by compensating perfectly for any exterior influences, certain kinds of force fields, according to Yang and Mills, will provide perfect compensation for shifts in force charges, thereby keeping the physical interactions between the particles completely unchanged. For the case of gauge symmetry associated with shifting quark color charges, the required force is none other than the strong force itself. That is, without the strong force, physics would change under the kinds of shifts of color charges indicated above. This realization shows that, although the gravitational force and the strong force have vastly different properties, recall, for example, that gravity is far feebler than the strong force and operates over enormously larger distances, they do have a somewhat similar heritage. They are each required in order that the universe embody particular symmetries. Moreover, a similar discussion applies to the weak and electromagnetic forces, showing that their existence, too, is bound up with yet other gauge symmetries, the so-called weak and electromagnetic gauge symmetries. And hence, all four forces are directly associated with principles of symmetry. This common feature of the four forces would seem to bode well for the suggestion made at the beginning of this section, namely, in our effort to incorporate quantum mechanics into general relativity, we should seek a quantum field theory of the gravitational force, much as physicists have discovered successful quantum field theories of the other three forces. Over the years, such reasoning has inspired a prodigious and distinguished group of physicists to follow this path vigorously, but the terrain has proven to be fraught with danger, and no one has succeeded in traversing it completely. Let's see why. General relativity versus quantum mechanics. The usual realm of applicability of general relativity is that of large astronomical distance scales. On such distances, Einstein's theory implies that the absence of mass means that space is flat. In seeking to merge general relativity with quantum mechanics, we must now change our focus sharply and examine the microscopic properties of space. Let's imagine zooming in and sequentially magnifying ever smaller regions of the flat spatial fabric. At first, as we zoom in, not much happens in the first levels of magnification. The structure of space retains the same basic form. Reasoning from a purely classical standpoint, we would expect this placid and flat image of space to persist all the way to arbitrarily small length scales. But quantum mechanics changes this conclusion radically. Everything is subject to the quantum fluctuations inherent in the uncertainty principle, even the gravitational field. Although classical reasoning implies that empty space has zero gravitational field, quantum mechanics shows that on average it is zero, but that its actual value undulates up and down due to quantum fluctuations. Moreover, the uncertainty principle tells us that the size of the undulations of the gravitational field gets larger as we focus our attention on smaller regions of space. Quantum mechanics shows that nothing likes to be cornered. Narrowing the spatial focus leads to ever larger undulations. As gravitational fields are reflected by curvature, these quantum fluctuations manifest themselves as increasingly violent distortions of the surrounding space. We can imagine the glimmers of such distortions emerging with ever-increasing magnification. By probing to even smaller distance scales, we can picture that the random quantum mechanical undulations in the gravitational field correspond to such severe warpings of space that it no longer resembles a gently curving geometrical object, such as the rubber membrane analogy used in our discussion in Chapter 3. Rather, it takes on a frothing, turbulent, twisted form. John Wheeler coined the term quantum foam to describe the frenzy revealed by such an ultra-microscopic examination of space and time. It describes the unfamiliar arena of the universe in which the conventional notions of left and right, back and forth, up and down, and even of before and after, lose their meaning. It is on such short-distance scales that we encounter the fundamental incompatibility between general relativity and quantum mechanics. The notion of a smooth spatial geometry, the central principle of general relativity, is destroyed by the violent fluctuations of the quantum world on short-distance scales. On ultramicroscopic scales, the central feature of quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle, is in direct conflict with the central feature of general relativity, the smooth geometrical model of space and of space-time. In practice, this conflict rears its head in a very concrete manner. Calculations that merge the equations of general relativity and those of quantum mechanics typically yield one and the same ridiculous answer, infinity. Like a sharp rap on the wrist from an old-time schoolteacher, an infinite answer is nature's way of telling us that we are doing something that is quite wrong. The equations of general relativity cannot handle the roiling frenzy of quantum foam. However, as we recede to more ordinary distances, the random, violent, small-scale undulations cancel each other out, in much the same way that, on average, our compulsive borrower's bank account shows no evidence of his compulsion, and the concept of a smooth geometry for the fabric of the universe once again becomes accurate. It's like what you experience when you look at a dot matrix picture. From far away, the dots that compose the picture blend together and create the impression of a smooth image whose variations in lightness seamlessly and gently change from one area to another. When you inspect the picture on finer distance scales, you realize, however, that it markedly differs from its smooth, long-distance appearance. It is nothing but a collection of discrete dots, each quite separate from the others. But note that you become aware of the discrete nature of the picture only when you examine it on the smallest of scales. From far away, it looks smooth. Similarly, the fabric of space-time appears to be smooth except when examined with ultramicroscopic precision. This is why general relativity works on large enough distance and time scales, the scales relevant for many typical astronomical applications, but is rendered inconsistent on short distance and time scales. The central tenet of a smooth and gently curving geometry is justified in the large, but breaks down due to quantum fluctuations when pushed to the small. The basic principles of general relativity and quantum mechanics allow us to calculate the approximate distance scales below which one would have to shrink in order for the pernicious phenomenon of quantum foam to become apparent. The smallness of Planck's constant, which governs the strength of quantum effects, and the intrinsic weakness of the gravitational force team up to yield a result called the Planck length, which is small almost beyond imagination, a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a centimeter, 10^-33 centimeter. The quantum foam level thus depicts the ultramicroscopic sub-Planck length landscape of the universe. To get a sense of scale, if we were to magnify an atom to the size of the known universe, the Planck length would barely expand to the height of an average tree. And so we see that the incompatibility between general relativity and quantum mechanics becomes apparent only in a rather esoteric realm of the universe. For this reason, you might well ask whether it's worth worrying about. In fact, the physics community does not speak with a unified voice when addressing this issue. There are those physicists who are willing to note the problem, but happily go about using quantum mechanics and general relativity for problems whose typical lengths far exceed the Planck length, as their research requires. There are other physicists, however, who are deeply unsettled by the fact that the two foundational pillars of physics as we know it are, at their core, fundamentally incompatible, regardless of the ultramicroscopic distances that must be probed to expose the problem. The incompatibility, they argue, points to an essential flaw in our understanding of the physical universe. This opinion rests on an unprovable but profoundly felt view that the universe, if understood at its deepest and most elementary level, can be described by a logically sound theory whose parts are harmoniously united. And surely, regardless of how central this incompatibility is to their own research, most physicists find it hard to believe that, at rock bottom, our deepest theoretical understanding of the universe will be composed of a mathematically inconsistent patchwork of two powerful yet conflicting explanatory frameworks. Physicists have made numerous attempts at modifying either general relativity or quantum mechanics in some manner so as to avoid the conflict, but the attempts, although often bold and ingenious, have met with failure after failure. That is, until the discovery of superstring theory. Part 3. The Cosmic Symphony. Chapter 6. Nothing But Music. The Essentials of Superstring Theory. Music has long since provided the metaphors of choice for those puzzling over the questions of cosmic concern. From the ancient Pythagorean music of the spheres to the harmonies of nature that have guided inquiry through the ages, we have collectively sought the song of nature in the gentle wanderings of celestial bodies and the riotous fulminations of subatomic particles. With the discovery of superstring theory, musical metaphors take on a startling reality, for the theory suggests that the microscopic landscape is suffused with tiny strings whose vibrational patterns orchestrate the evolution of the cosmos. The winds of change, according to superstring theory, gust through an Aeolian universe. By contrast, the standard model views the elementary constituents of the universe as point-like ingredients with no internal structure. As powerful as this approach is, as we have mentioned, essentially every prediction about the micro-world made by the standard model has been verified down to about a billionth of a billionth of a meter, the present-day technological limit. The standard model cannot be a complete or final theory because it does not include gravity. Moreover, attempts to incorporate gravity into its quantum mechanical framework have failed due to the violent fluctuations in the spatial fabric that appear at ultramicroscopic distances, that is, distances shorter than the Planck length. The unresolved conflict has impelled a search for an even deeper understanding of nature. In 1984, the physicists Michael Green, then of Queen Mary College, and John Schwartz of the California Institute of Technology provided the first piece of convincing evidence that superstring theory, or string theory for short, might well provide this understanding. String theory offers a novel and profound modification to our theoretical description of the ultramicroscopic properties of the universe, a modification that, physicists slowly realized, alters Einstein's general relativity in just the right way to make it fully compatible with the laws of quantum mechanics. According to string theory, the elementary ingredients of the universe are not point particles. Rather, they are tiny, one-dimensional filaments, somewhat like infinitely thin rubber bands, vibrating to and fro. But don't let the name fool you. Unlike an ordinary piece of string, which is itself composed of molecules and atoms, the strings of string theory are purported to lie deep within the heart of matter. The theory proposes that they are ultramicroscopic ingredients making up the particles out of which atoms themselves are made. The strings of string theory are so small, on average they are about as long as the Planck length, that they appear point-like, even when examined with our most powerful equipment. Yet the simple replacement of point particles with strands of string as the fundamental ingredients of everything has far-reaching consequences. First and foremost, string theory appears to resolve the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics. As we shall see, the spatially extended nature of a string is the crucial new element allowing for a single harmonious framework incorporating both theories. Second, string theory provides a truly unified theory, since all matter and all forces are proposed to arise from one basic ingredient, oscillating strings. Finally, as discussed more fully in subsequent chapters, beyond these remarkable achievements, string theory once again radically changes our understanding of space-time. A brief history of string theory. In 1968, a young theoretical physicist named Gabriele Veneziano was struggling to make sense of various experimentally observed properties of the strong nuclear force. Veneziano, then a research fellow at CERN, the European Accelerator Laboratory in Geneva, Switzerland, had worked on aspects of this problem for a number of years, until one day he came upon a striking revelation. Much to his surprise, he realized that an esoteric formula concocted for purely mathematical pursuits by the renowned Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler some 200 years earlier, the so-called Euler beta function, seemed to describe numerous properties of strongly interacting particles in one fell swoop. Veneziano's observation provided a powerful mathematical encapsulation of many features of the strong force, and it launched an intense flurry of research aimed at using Euler's beta function and various generalizations to describe the surfeit of data being collected at various atom smashers around the world. Nevertheless, there was a sense in which Veneziano's observation was incomplete. Like memorized formulae used by a student who does not understand their meaning or justification, Euler's beta function seemed to work, but no one knew why. It was a formula in search of an explanation. This changed in 1970 when the works of Yoichiro Nambu of the University of Chicago, Holger Nielsen of the Niels Bohr Institute, and Leonard Susskind of Stanford University revealed the hitherto unknown physics lurking behind Euler's formula. These physicists showed that if one modeled elementary particles as little, vibrating one-dimensional strings, their nuclear interactions could be described exactly by Euler's function. If the pieces of string were small enough, they reasoned, they would still look like point particles, and hence could be consistent with experimental observations. Although this provided an intuitively simple and pleasing theory, it was not too long before the string description of the strong force was shown to fail. During the early 1970s, high-energy experiments capable of probing the subatomic world more deeply showed that the string model made a number of predictions that were in direct conflict with observations. At the same time, the point particle quantum field theory of quantum chromodynamics was being developed, and its overwhelming success in describing the strong force led to the dismissal of string theory. Most particle physicists thought that string theory had been relegated to the dustbin of science, but a few dedicated researchers kept at it. Schwartz, for instance, felt that the mathematical structure of string theory was so beautiful and had so many miraculous properties that it had to be pointing towards something deep. One of the problems physicists found with string theory was that it seemed to have a true embarrassment of riches. The theory contained configurations of vibrating string that had properties akin to those of gluons, substantiating its early claim of being a theory of the strong force. But beyond these, it contained additional messenger-like particles that did not appear to have any relevance to experimental observations of the strong force. In 1974, Schwartz and Joel Schurk of the École Normale Supérieure made a bold leap that transformed this apparent vice into a virtue. After studying the puzzling messenger-like patterns of string vibration, they realized that their properties matched perfectly those of the hypothesized messenger particle of the gravitational force, the graviton. Although these smallest bundles of the gravitational force have, as yet, never been seen, theorists can confidently predict certain basic features that they must possess, and Schurk and Schwartz found these properties to be realized exactly by certain vibrational patterns. Based on this, Schurk and Schwartz suggested that string theory had failed in its initial attempt because physicists had unduly constrained its scope. String theory is not just a theory of the strong force, they proclaimed. It is a quantum theory that includes gravity as well. The physics community did not receive this suggestion with unbridled enthusiasm. In fact, Schwartz recounts that our work was universally ignored. The path of progress was already littered with numerous failed attempts to unite gravity and quantum mechanics. String theory had been shown wrong in its initial effort to describe the strong force, and it seemed to many that it was senseless to try to use the theory to pursue an even grander goal. Even more devastating, subsequent studies during the late 1970s and early 1980s showed that string theory and quantum mechanics suffered from their own subtle conflicts. It appeared that the gravitational force had, once again, resisted incorporation into the microscopic description of the universe. Such was the case until 1984. In a landmark paper, culminating more than a dozen years of intense research that had been largely ignored and often outright dismissed by most physicists, Green and Schwartz established that the subtle quantum conflict afflicting string theory could be resolved. Moreover, they showed that the resulting theory had sufficient breadth to encompass all of the four forces and all of matter as well. As word of this result spread throughout the worldwide physics community, particle physicists by the hundreds dropped their research projects to launch a full-scale assault on what appeared to be the last theoretical battleground in the ancient quest to understand the deepest workings of the universe. I began graduate school at Oxford University in October 1984. Although I was excited to be learning about the likes of quantum field theory, gauge theory, and general relativity, there was a pervasive feeling among the older graduate students that there was little or no future for particle physics. The standard model was in place, and its remarkable success at predicting experimental outcomes indicated that its verification was merely a matter of time and details. Going beyond its limits to include gravity and possibly to explain the experimental input on which it relies, the 19 numbers summarizing the elementary particle masses, their force charges, and the relative strengths of the forces, numbers that are known from experiment but are not understood theoretically, was so daunting a task that all but the most courageous physicists recoiled at the challenge. But 6 months later, the mood had swung completely around. The success of Green and Schwartz finally trickled down even to first-year graduate students, and an electrifying sense of being on the inside of a profound moment in the history of physics displaced the previous ennui. A number of us consistently worked deep into the night to try to master the vast areas of theoretical physics and abstract mathematics that are required to understand string theory. The period from 1984 to 1986 has come to be known as the first superstring revolution. During those 3 years, more than 1,000 research papers on string theory were written by physicists from around the world. These works showed conclusively that numerous features of the Standard Model, features that had been painstakingly discovered over the course of decades of research, emerged naturally and simply from the grand structure of string theory. As Michael Green has said, the moment you encounter string theory and realize that almost all of the major developments in physics over the last 100 years emerge, and emerge with such elegance, from such a simple starting point, you realize that this incredibly compelling theory is in a class of its own.